The topic today is Yibum and Chalitza in contemporary times. So some of you could probably go on YU Torah and listen to the lecture that I gave at Gross about a month ago about practical aspects of Chalitza, where I discussed many of the Inyanim. So I probably will touch upon some of those subjects today, but I also thought that I would go through a real-life Chalitza issue with you, and also, which won't come across on the recorder, but I'm showing a Chalitza shoe to the class at this moment in time, and also maybe run through some of the aspects of the Seder HaChalitza and how the standard Seder HaChalitza that we use nowadays flows from the Psukim, and what is Li'ikuva, what's not Li'ikuva, what practically needs to be done in order to make sure that we do Chalitza properly. So just as background, since the title of the Shir covers Yibum and Chalitza, so we don't really have Yibum so much in contemporary times. There's a machlokis in the Mishnah and the Gemara, which you're familiar with, between Abishol and the Chachamim, as to whether mitzvahs chalitza kodemis or whether mitzvahs Yibum kodemis. And the Gemara on Daf Lametes Amud Beis seems to indicate that at first the assumption was that mitzvahs chalitza comes first and is preferable, and then it was assumed that at the end that chazu loma mitzvahs yibum kodemis and mitzvahs chalitza, the mitzvahs yibum would be preferable. What is the svara behind the Abishol? The svara behind the Abishol says the mitzvahs chalitza kodemis is that he holds that akone says yibimto l'shem noy l'shem shumishus l'shum davar acher, that if somebody would perform the mitzvah of yibum and would do it in a fashion in which they would have ulterior motives, that what is, first of all, what are we talking about? We're talking about, well, the whole yeshiva is learning Maseches Yevamos this year, so I assume it doesn't require too much of an introduction. But whenever we have a situation of a man who is married to a woman, and the man has a brother, and the man dies without any children, so then the woman is zikuka to the brother, meaning she's not allowed to marry anybody else. There's a zika with the brother, and the brother has to either marry her, perform yibum, or perform chalitza, which would release her to be able to marry anybody else. So Abishol says that if the brother-in-law performs this yibum, performs this marriage in a fashion in which he's really just doing it because she's beautiful or because she's wealthy, but not for the mitzvah, then it's ki'ilu pogeya be'erva. Then it's as if the heter that the Torah provides for Eishes Ahav is not operable, and it's as if they have violated the Yisra of Eishes Ach, despite the fact that it's b'makom mitzvah of Yibum. And not only that, but any child who would be born from that marriage, it would be Karov, it would be kind of in his eyes as if the child would be a mamzer. So there's a question as to whether Abishol is on a Durabanan level, Duraisa level. The Mukayosi seems to hold that this is a Din Durabanan. The Ramban seems to hold it's a Din Duraisa. But regardless, it would seem that according to Abishol, if the person actually would perform Yibum, even with ulterior motives, it would seem that it actually would work. It would still actually be a Yibum. And it doesn't seem like, if you look at the Lashon, the Rishonim point out, where the Abishol says, Ki ilu pogeh be'er, karvani be'nai liyosav lan mamzer, that it's not real. It's not that the child actually is a mamzer. It's not that there actually is a violation of erva, but it is unseemly, and therefore it's something which Abishol prefers not to do. So halacha l'maise, the mechaber paskins like the chachamim, paskins like the pashtus of the Gemara and Yibama Stav Lametes Amid Beis, that the maskana is the mitzvahs yibum kodemis, and the mama paskins that we would, as a default principle, assume like Abishol, the mitzvahs chalitza kodemis, and therefore chalitza should be performed and not yibum. And this is consistent with the Gemara on Daf Kuf Tes Amud Aleph, which says Tani Bar Kapara Liolam Yidbak Adam Mishlosha Dvarim Bachalitza Ka Abishol, that a person should always follow three different matters, and one of the three matters is that one should cling to the shita of Abishol, that they should always try to do chalitza. So in the Ashkenazi community, we pretty much don't don't allow Yibum. We say that we would do Chalitza pretty much across the board. Even though the Rama says that if it's obvious that both the Yavam and Yavam are Mekavim L'Shem Mitzvah, that they both have in mind just to perform the Mitzvah, then you could, in fact, even in the Ashkenazic community, do Yibum, but general assumption is that we're worried that it's not going to be L'Shem Mitzvah, so therefore we don't do Yibum in the Ashkenazic community. We only do Chalitza. Even in the Sephardic community, there was a declaration that was passed when the Medina in Israel was established. There was a declaration that was passed by the two chief rabbis in the year Tafshin Yud. That's 62 years ago. So 62 years ago, that would be 1950. Approximately the two Rabbanim Harashim, who were at that time Rabbi Herzog and Rabbi Uziel, both issued a declaration saying that even for the Sephardic community, they were not going to allow Yibum anymore. Everybody would have to do Chalitza, no more of this Yibum business. So Rabbi Avadya Yosef has a couple of very strongly worded tshuvos in which Rabbi Avadya Yosef protested against this declaration and held that they could not, in fact, go against the law as codified by the Mechaber, go against Torah law and Torah tradition, that at least in the Sephardic community, mitzvahs Yibum Choletzis, and he complained that they had both gone against the Mechaber, and that they had been Yotzim Biyad Ramah, as he puts it, that they had insisted on following the position of the Ramah, little play on words, and he actively paskined against this declaration, and he even gave cases that a couple came in front of him, and he said, I don't care about the declaration, you should definitely, if you're from the Sephardic community and you want to do Yibum, you should definitely do Yibum, and he actually allowed Yibum even many years after the declaration was passed. 24 years. He wrote a tshuva in Chelech Ches, in Tavshin Lamed Daled, which is 24 years after the declaration was passed, and he ruled in that they should do Yibum, and then he writes a little footnote at the end of his tshuva, because he sent them a tshuva saying it's okay to do Yibum, and then when he published it, he said, V'chein nasem aysel pias kamasi, and he says, and in fact, this is what they did, based on my permission, so that a reader should not think that this is only theoretical, that he actually allowed it. But the reality is that given the declaration, given the mindset, given just the passage of generations and the lack of Sephardi countries kind of standing alone, and the fact that we live more in a more integrated fashion, the reality is that there's less and less Yibum nowadays even in the Sephardi community. But the question sometimes arises that there are occasions when Chalitza would be impossible to perform. Chalitza requires that the Yavama, that the woman, remove the shoe from her brother-in-law's, from the Yavam's foot, and it has to be that he has a foot. But let's say he doesn't have any feet. Let's say that both of his feet are amputated beneath the knee. So this question came up. Actually, Rav Soloveitchik dealt with this question. It's reported in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav. I think I have it in the sources. So he writes, Eitzel Ashkenazim, this is page Reish Samachay of the Nefesh HaRav, page 20 of the materials. Eitzel Ashkenazim, Mekubo Kedasa, Beinotam, Betosis, Yibama, Shalacha, Kabashol. It's established that the halacha is like Abashol, the mitzvah Chalitza Kodemis. There was a time that they had a maaseh where the yavam could not do chalitza, kiniktu raglav, his legs, his feet were amputated. So the Rav said, told his students that when he had this situation, he consulted with Rav Chaim Heller. And he said that if you look, there are many achronim who say that in such a case you can allow yibum to take place. And then he adds, on condition that a get be given. And this is in fact what they did. So I asked Rav Shechter the other day this business about amenas liten get. So does that mean that when we do allow it in the Ashkenazic community, in other words, in this case, they allow yibum, and because there was no other out, and then of course the woman would be permitted to anybody, but it says amenas liten get. Does that mean that we only permit it in the event that he's going to give a get afterwards, that because of the fact that we don't normally allow chalitza in the Ashkenazic community, we don't allow yibum unwind, if we don't allow Yibum in the Ashkenazi community, so when we do allow Yibum in the Ashkenazi community, we would require a get immediately afterwards because we're worried that it's Ki'ilu Pogea Be'erva. So it's interesting. I was in Houston this past Shabbos, and I was talking to the rabbi of the Young Israel there, Rabbi Wender, a fine Talmid Chacham. And I was talking about how the yeshiva is learning Yavama, so we were talking a little bit about Yibum v'chalitza issues. So I mentioned this psak, that when chalitza can't be performed, when it's impossible because the fellow's legs are amputated, so you have a number of achronim who are paskin. It was a machlokas, the Shev Yaakov and the Shvus Yaakov. The Shev Yaakov held based on the Tosfos, I think, in Memdag, which ain't all chalitza, ain't all Yibum. Chalitza can't be performed, Yibum can't be performed, the Shvus Yaakov paskin against the Shev Yaakov. Pretty much everybody else paskin against the Shev Yaakov held that when it would be impossible for Chalitza to be performed because of some physical impairment, it certainly would be possible to perform Yibum. So is it necessary for a get to be given immediately afterwards? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has in his, when I was discussing with Rabbi Wender, we both kind of raised this question. He asked me, why is it that a get was given afterwards? So I said, well, it could be she probably didn't want to be married to him. She wasn't looking to be married to this fellow. It was just that we performed Yibum. And once the Yibum was done, so it was appropriate for him at that point to give her a get so that she would be able to go on and marry somebody else now that the Yibum had been taken care of. But let's say they wanted to stay together. Would we say that if you hold like Abba Shaul, when you do allow a Yibum, they have to get divorced immediately afterwards? So Moshe Feinstein has in his Chidushim, that on Yevamos, he thinks not. He thinks that according to Abba Shaul, once we would allow for whatever reason, even according to Abba Shaul, for the first bia to take place, we're not worried about the kavan and subsequent bias. The only kapedis with respect to the first bia. So once the first bia would be okay, then presumably they could be married afterwards. If you look at the various achronim who talk about this idea of amanas liten get, this is because get would needed to be given for other reasons. Many of them are talking about a case where the man was married to another woman, and where we have a principle of Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, that you're not supposed to be married to more than one woman. So because of Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, even when they would allow the Yibum, they would do it in such a way that he would give a get afterwards so he wouldn't remain married to two women. That's a separate problem. It's a side issue that since Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, we don't allow marriage to more than one person. So even though there's a discussion that maybe we relax that in Makom Mitzvah, but after the first Bia, so in order not to be remain in that state of being married to the women, so they would allow a get to be given. And there's some discussion. Let's say they just wouldn't want to remain married. The Achiezer, you look in the Achiezer, Chelek Gimel, Simon Chof, where he talks about a case also where the person has a foot that's not appropriate for Chalitza, a crooked foot. And therefore, he performs Yibum in that case. So when he talks about doing the Yibum for purposes of giving a get, but it appears that it's for purposes of giving a get because the Yavam is doing it as a big favor and he doesn't want to stay married to this woman. So that's almost like a leniency. That is a chumra that we require a get to be given. It's a leniency, despite the fact that it's being given in such a way where the plan is that a get is going to be given immediately afterwards. Nonetheless, we consider this to be sufficient, even though he's not going to, the purpose of Yibum is to be able to perpetuate the family name and maybe to be able to bear offspring, and it's not going to be likely if they're only together for one night, but nonetheless we would consider Yibum to be fulfilled, and we would consider this to be sufficient even though he gives a get afterwards. So Pashtus is that it's not necessarily the case that the get is required simply because of the fact that we paskin like Abba Shaul, and therefore we only allow the Yibum for one bia and then require a get afterwards. That doesn't necessarily seem to be the flow. But Lamaisa, in these cases, since it's really being done as an accommodation, not because the two people want to be married to each other, but it's being done, in fact, that's a good thing, according to Abba Shaul, but it's being done because of the fact that Chalitza is impossible, so therefore, even though a get's going to be given afterwards, so we do the Yibum, and that's considered to be good enough. That appears to be the explanation as to the practice. So there's an interesting Maritz Chias who says that the reason why the practice of Yibum fell into disuse in general was not just because of our preference for Abba Shaul, but because there is what he calls, this is source number 5, a very compelling reason in the modern age. He's talking about the modern age going back a long time ago. He says, Shemati b'shem agon maratzal, based in the Berlin, To be zeh tam butlo yom mitzvos yibum. Afagav the halacha the chalitza makam yibum yibum la mitzvah. He says the reason why we did away with mitzvos yibum is because the pasuk says that yibum is only performed. There's only a zika if uvein ein lo. If the person who died doesn't have any children. But if he has a child. Even a grandchild, he has offspring, descendants who are still alive in the world, that's when there's a Zika, that's when you do Yibum. But if he does have, if he has no descendants, that's when there's Zika. But if he has descendants, so then there would be a regular Isser Erva of Eishes Ach for the Yavama to marry for the sister-in-law to marry the brother-in-law. That would be an Isser Ervas. That would be an Isser Kares. That would be terrible. So therefore, he says that even if we think that there are no children at the promiscuous age that we live in, who knows what kind of affairs this fellow may have had. We don't know about all his private life and his secret life. Maybe at some point he had an indiscretion, he had an affair with a lady, and there's a child out there that we don't know about. Because of his man achon, lo aksha dora, that now we're living in promiscuous times. Ulai yesh lo aksha mesa bein mechol mikol makom. Maybe the husband who died does have a child somewhere. Some what we would call an illegitimate child, right? He has some sort of a child that nobody talks about. Then in fact it would be a regular erva, and you would have no heter for the yibum to take place. But tamze emes, and he says that he thinks that don't think that I'm just telling a joke. He says tamze emes, this is a very truthful reason. Roy lefarsimo, and this should be publicized. He thinks there's some publicizing it. So he thinks that this is another reason why we shouldn't allow yibum nowadays. Maybe there'll be a child somewhere. So if you look in you look in the Sefer Chalitza Kehilkosa, there's a very nice two-volume work called Chalitza Kehilkosa that has lots and lots of contemporary tshuvos having to do with Chalitza and Yibum issues. So then the Sefer Chalitza Kehilkosa, presents a different reason why maybe Yibum could be a problematic nowadays. He brings a tshuva by Rav Nosson Gestetner about the following situation. Let's say that a man dies, and he doesn't have any children, in fact, but he left some zera. He was left some zera for purposes of artificial insemination procedures, and the zera was never really utilized. But then, sometime after his death, the zera gets utilized and impregnates somebody, and then a child is born. So he thinks that since if you look at the discussion in Tosos and Daf Lamed Heyam and Aleph in explaining the Machlokas Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish about whether Chalitza is Me'uberes, whether Chalitza done on a pregnant lady is considered to be a good Chalitza or not. So in the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan Shita, who says that it could conceivably be a good chalitza, but nothing counts if a child is born afterwards. So he says that's because one of the psukim that talks about when there would be a yibum or a chalitza is for purposes of a lo yimach shemo miyisrael, that we not erase the person's name. But if in fact it's going to turn out that the person's name is not going to be erased in the end because the child's going to be born from his zera, so then there's no erasure of the person's name. Since there's no erasure of the person's name, whatever took place when she was that would cancel out the effect of any yibum of any chalitza, and it would turn out that it was not necessary for there to be a yibum or for there to be a chalitza. So, in this case as well, where the artificial insemination is going to be used even after the person's death, you're going to have a situation where it's v'lo yimach shemo miyisrael, where there's no michoy of his name, and therefore I don't need the yibum to take place for the michoy of his name. So it'll turn out the yibum was never really needed. So this could be good for an aguna case, right, where a woman has a brother-in-law who's refusing to do yibum or chalitza, but she can access some zera, right, from that was put away by her husband. So since she can access the zera, and now she can have the child, so it'll turn out when she had the child, and now lo and behold, she's betura miyibum v'chalitza, and now she can go on with her life after having the child. So you could say that maybe you have to be worried in any single case. Why allow yibum? Maybe the fellow left some zera somewhere that's going to be used. If you're going to take the svara of the maritzkias, I think that would be a little bit of an extreme application. Even the maritzkias' application is disputed by many others. It's considered to be far-fetched. If it doesn't look to us like, where are yenala? The Gemara says you have to look and investigate. You don't find any children, so there are no children. So here too, maybe you don't have to worry that there's zera that was left behind that's going to develop into a child. But that assumption that he had is not muskam either. There was a tshuva that I included in the materials in the Shail Tshuvas B'Marei HaBazak by Rav Shaul Yisraeli. We have Rav Shaul Yisraeli Paskin, and you find this as well in the Shail Tshuvas of the Mincha Shlomo. Shlomo Zalman Orbach comes to a similar conclusion in Chayla Gimel Simen Kufkab Dalet, I believe. That if a he holds that, that if on the, at the moment of death, if at the moment of death there was no child that was in the world or even in the mother's in the wife's womb that she was pregnant with, then it doesn't matter if Zera was left somewhere else. That Zera has no bearing on the mitzvah of Yibum or Chalitza. If she was Petura, Yibum or Chalitza at that time, so even if a child is born from the Zera of the husband months later or years later, it's not going to cancel out the fact that it was permissible for her to perform Yibum, and for that matter necessary for her to perform either Yibum or Chalitza in order to be able to go on with her life. In the tshuva of Rav Shaul Yisraeli, he brings a proof from this from the shita of the Noda B'Yehuda. Noda B'Yehuda has a very novel shita. He says, why is it there's a halacha that you have to wait 3 months after the husband's death before yibum or chalitza can be performed? Why is that? Because if she's pregnant, then the chalitza would be no good. Even if the child, if it turns out that she was pregnant, then chalitza's muberes, we paskin is not a good chalitza. So therefore, we have to wait until it's clear that she's not pregnant. And if she became pregnant the day of the husband's death, we assume that it takes 3 months until hukar ubra. It takes 3 months until we would recognize that a woman is pregnant. So therefore, we wait. And then after 3 months, we look and see, does she look pregnant? She doesn't look pregnant. And then we're ready to do the yibum, we're ready to do the chalitza. But until 3 months, we can't do it. Why not wait? He has to know the Behuda 3 months and 3 days. We know that sometimes it could take up to 3 days for the Zera to be fertilized until Nikletes HaZera. The Haklata Zera could take up to 3 days. So he says, well, this must prove that if there was only a potential for the Zera to be fertilized, but it wasn't fertilized yet at the time of death, even if it becomes fertilized 3 days later and a child would be born, so that wouldn't bother us. So it turned out that she did the Yibum, and then 3 days later we see it's Hukar Ubra because it only became fertilized 3 days after the husband's death. So the Chalitza was performed 3 months later, and 3 months and 3 days later suddenly we see that she's pregnant. So we're not worried about that. Why? Because it wouldn't make a difference. So Noda B'Yuda suggests that this might be the case, and the Noda B'Yuda ultimately says, but I recognize this is tremendously novel and mechudishtik, and therefore I'm not telling anybody to rely upon this. And even in the case that he was dealing with, it was a case where the woman gave birth something like 9 months and 3 weeks, or 9 months and 2 weeks after the husband had died. And the question was, can we assume it was the husband's Zera? And then Noda B'Yuda says, yes, you could assume it's the husband's Zera, and she's Petua Me'yubim Me'chalitza. And he throws in that even though, in theory, he might accept this proposition that if the Zera was there but not fertilized for a few days, that she would not be Zekuka Le'ibim, he thinks that in all probability, even if the pregnancy took a long time, usually the Haklata Zera takes place immediately. It doesn't wait 3 days. It takes place immediately. So therefore, he didn't really consider this to be such a halach l'maisa chiddush. So Rav Shaul Yisraeli takes this chiddush of the Noda B'Yehuda and he makes it into halach l'maisa with respect to Zera that's put into some sort of a Zera bank that's going to be utilized for future impregnation. And he also brings a raya from the Gemara Pei Zayin Amud Beis that asks the question, we know that if a woman has a child from this man, let's say the man has a child, it doesn't have to be from this woman, the man had a child and the child died before his death. So this is an important halakha, it's not intuitive. But the halakha, Rabbi Kiva Eger had a case like this where they got the halakha wrong and made a mistake in terms of the fact that the woman didn't, they blew this, she didn't need to be chalitza, but she did need chalitza. The halakha is that if a man has a child and the child dies before his death, so then it's considered like he doesn't have children. It doesn't matter that he had children. He could have had 10 children before. And if all the children died, Rahman al-Islam, before he died, so then his wife, who he leaves behind, requires Yibum or Chalitza. So the Gemara asks, Well, what about then if they have a child at the time of his death and that child dies 3 years later? So do we say that now 3 years later she's going to require yumim or chalitza, or do we say that since at the moment of death there was a viable child out there, therefore she doesn't require subsequent yumim or chalitza? So the Gemara says that once we're going to permit her to marry Lashuk, she can marry into the marketplace, she can marry anybody, go into the shidduch world and get married to somebody, because we assume that she didn't require yibum or chalitza because there was a child, so we can't take that away from her subsequently, because dirachei hadarchei noam mechuna sivo seha shalom. So it actually paskins this from dirachei hadarchei noam. So therefore, Rosh Yisraeli says the same thing over here. He says that if we're going, a woman, let's say, would perform yibum, that the child, that this is the reverse case, the husband dies and we assume there are no children, and now she's going to perform yibum, and then some zera of his is going to produce a child 5 years down the road. So we're going to say that it turned out retroactively she committed a terrible sin, that she was over an iser eva. No, it can't be. So he brings the raya from the pasuk derachei hadarchei noam. But the truth of the matter is that you could argue the reverse with the pasuk derachei hadarchei noam, because nowadays we don't do yibum. We're going to do chalitza, generally speaking, and we're not going to have to worry about this case where she's marrying the brother-in-law. What we have to worry about is a case where the brother-in-law will refuse to perform chalitza. Then she'll be an aguna. So now this is wonderful. So now we have another way for her to avoid being an aguna, if in fact by virtue of this zera being utilized, she'll be able to marry again. So therefore, the argument could conceivably cut in the opposite direction as well. In the Sefer Chalitza Kehilkosa, he assumes, even though Rosh Yisraeli raises questions about this as well, he doesn't quote Rosh Yisraeli, but he assumes, of course, Acheshik Shlomo and others, that if the child, let's say, who was born through artificial insemination, let's use less of a science fiction case, but more of a practical, more likely, realistic case, where a man dies and he had a child, but the child was born through artificial insemination, through his zera, but only through his zera of artificial insemination, not to a regular bia. So the Sefer Chalitza Kehilkosa assumes that in such a case, for sure she would be patur miyumim mezika. That we say ubein ein lo, that any that ayena love, that any kind of bein, we say any kind of bein, any kind of zera is considered to be good enough. So even if you have questions about the yichus of artificial insemination, maybe when it comes to other halachos, when it comes to the halacha of yumim chalitza, should be no questions at all. Bein mikol makom. Any type of bein should be good enough in order to patur her from yibum v'chalitza. So certainly if this child through artificial insemination was born before he died, so then you should be free and clear, then it should be perfectly okay. This question of waiting did I say waiting 30 days? I have to revise what I said. It's waiting 90 days. It's waiting 3 months. I say I got mixed up with the 3 and the 9. It's waiting 3 months and 90 days. You wait 3 months in order to see whether a woman is pregnant or not. So then the question was, do you have to wait 3 months, 3 days? I think I said that part correctly. So this sometimes is a question. What if you know for a fact that the woman is not pregnant during the three-month period? And you're worried that if you don't get the Yavam to do the Chalitza right away, he's going to run away and he's not going to be willing to do the Chalitza. So from our Gemara, it seems, at least B'di'evit, if you do a Chalitza during the 90-day period and she really wasn't pregnant, that the Chalitza could be kosher. But the Ramah brings down, I think it's based on the Yerushalmi, the Ramah brings down that it's a Chalitza Psula, and it's an invalid Chalitza, and then it has to be repeated after the 90 days. So it's a question as to how worried we need to be about the Ramah. So since the Babli seems to be of the opinion that the Chalitza really b'di'evit should be okay, so it could be that maybe we would say Shasat Chak y'di'evit dami. So Moshe Feinstein has in his first chelik of Eben Ezer a question about this type of situation. He's not so crazy about saying Shasat Chak y'di'evit dami for purposes of this halacha, but Rav Avadya Yosef in Chelik Ches of Yabia Omer and a few other poskim as well are of the opinion that if you have a case where you're really worried that if you don't snatch the brother-in-law now, he's never going to be willing to do the Chalitza again, that you could do it within the 90 days if you are able to establish that she's really not pregnant, and if you can get him to do it again after the 90 days, Matova Manoim, but at least this would count for something, and it would be Rabbi Yosef Paskins, it would be better than not doing it at all. I once had a case where in the Bezdin they wanted to do the Chalitza within the 90 days because they were afraid that if they didn't snatch the guy right away, maybe they wouldn't be able to get him to do the chalitza afterwards. And I mentioned that Rav Moshe wasn't so crazy about it. I mentioned according to the Ramah, it's a chalitza psula. So the Rav heard, the Ramah paskes it's a chalitza psula, so he didn't push it anymore. So I ended up with a case once. Upon an examination of the facts, it wasn't such a shasat chak. They were nervous, but there weren't objective reasons to be nervous. The guy did the chalitza afterwards. I had one case where the brother-in-law, this was a case in Philadelphia, the halacha is you gotta wait 3 months, you gotta wait 90 days, plus the day of death, plus the day of the chalitza itself. So if you count the day of death, and that's day number one, so the day of chalitza has to be at least day 92, from counting the day of death as day number one. So that's how we count the 90 days. So this was a case where the brother-in-law was willing to do the chalitza, but the only day that worked for him, and they were worried that it would take who knows how long, he was not so well either. It might take months, it might take a couple of years before they'd be able to synchronize everybody's schedule again to get him to do it. So the one day that he was willing to do it was day number 92. It was mamish that day, day number 92 itself. So I must have counted on my calendar about 10 times just to make sure that I wasn't miscalculating. He said, can't we do it day 93, 94, a little bit of wiggle room? So, no, it was mamish day 92. So we went and we did the chalitza on day 92. But if you do it at that point in time, then that's okay. So that's one of the questions that you have to ask when you have a chalitza situation. You have to ask, have the 90 days passed? And you have to ask, are we sure that there are no other children? Obviously, it's not going to hurt to do a chalitza, except that a chalitza makes a asua l'kohen. So if you come to the conclusion she needs a chalitza, so a chalitza is psula l'kohuna. But you have to ask some other questions as well. So I can provide a little bit of our chalitza checklist over here. So the Gemara in Daf Lamed Tes, this is page 26. The Gemara in Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis says that you have to identify the parties to make sure she's really the Yavama and he's really the brother-in-law. And you can have one aide identify them. So we always try to find one aide. It's not regular aides. It's just Hakara Biyama. It could be an Isha. It could be a Shifcha. It can be a relative, but you just need to bring somebody who has a familiarity with the individuals. So that's ideal. So you try to get at least one witness to come along. You have other pictures of identification just to supplement it, but you need that as well. You also, in order to establish that it's at least 90 days or 92 days, so you get the death certificate. So that's one of the things that we make sure nowadays. It's also necessary. We talk about ki yeshvu achim yachdav. That's how the whole parsha begins in Dvarim Perakopei. You need the yibum to be performed by the brother. So you have to make sure that they're brothers halakhically. Brothers halakhically mean that they're both brothers of the same father. So you have to ask to make sure that both of the brothers are from the same father. If they're only related to the mother, then this brother is not going to be suitable for yibum purposes. They both have to be from the same father. And then you find out since there is an inyan that it's supposed to be the Hayya Bechor Asher Teled, and the next pasuk we learn means that the oldest brother should do the chalitza. So you try to get if there are multiple brothers, you get the oldest brother. But the Yevit, if you have a younger brother, the chalitza is still kosher, as long as he's not a katan. You can't have a katan do a chalitza, but as long as he's a gadol, then he can do the chalitza. Some poskim are of the opinion that if the older brother is married and a yibum situation would require violation of Chaimim Drabbeinu Gershom, because then he would be married to two wives, then in a situation of chalitza as well, it's not ideal for this husband or brother, because he wouldn't ideally have been able to do the yibum to do the chalitza, and you should have the younger brother, if he's not married, do the chalitza instead, that then the hiddur would be to have the younger brother. That's a little bit of a machlokus, but there is an opinion like that as well. The Ramah brings down that the fact that this woman is not permitted to marry anybody else without first doing a chalitza from the brother has ramifications to the brother as well. If he's already married, he could stay married to his wife. We even say to him, even if you're married, you would still be able to do yibum, halakhically speaking. But Let's say that he's not married and he wants to get married. So the Mamma brings down that he's not allowed to get married. None of the brothers are allowed to get married until they remove the Zika from the sister-in-law. So we had a case this past year where there was some question about whether a brother-in-law was going to do chalitza or not. I mentioned at one point that somebody should mention to this brother-in-law that he wasn't so thrilled about doing chalitza for whatever reason. He's a single fellow. He's not going to be able to get married until he takes care of the chalitza. So that's an important point. I mean, Baruch Hashem, well, the case was taken care of. We actually had two chalitzas here in the yeshiva this past year. They weren't so well publicized because the people were not looking for a grand a spectacle of hundreds of talmidim watching a chalitza. We had two chalitzas over the course of this year. Little known fact. One of them took place on January 1st. They were both in the Bezdin room on the fifth floor. There are two cases that required chalitza. So you have to so the brother is not allowed to get married if he's still single. He's not allowed to get married until chalitza is performed. If he's meshudach, if he's engaged, so then the Ramah brings that. If he's meshudach, so then we allow him to go forward with a marriage. We don't stop him from getting married if he's already engaged. But if he wasn't even engaged, so then we don't allow him to get married. That's the halacha. The next thing on the checklist, you make sure that there are no live issue, children or grandchildren, as we made. The dayanim should be Jewish from birth. What does that mean? The dayanim should be Jewish from birth? Because there's a question as to whether a ger can serve as a dayan. Normally a ger is possible from being a dayan, but ger donis chavero a ger. A ger is allowed to be a dayan for another ger. But even if the yavam is a ger, it doesn't make a difference over here. A ger is possible because it says in the pasuk, and this is a real psul, this would be a chalitza psula mamish, if you had a dayan who was a ger. The pasuk says very clearly, be Yisrael. That this process is taking place be Yisrael, v'nikrashimo be Yisrael. So therefore, I require, and it says I require that it be a proceeding which has dayanim who are Yisraelim from birth. And since it says Yisrael, not only they have to be Jewish from birth, but their parents have to have been Jewish from birth. There's a question if the father was Jewish from birth, but the mother was a convert, maybe that's okay. Just not to take any chances, we make sure that every single dayan, particularly in a chalitza case, this is where it's brought down the halacha, that the dayanim, we ask the dayanim before the chalitza, were you all born Jewish and were your parents born Jewish? It's very important for a chalitza. And then, of course, that the dayanim can't be related to each other or to the yavam or the yavama. How many dayanim are there? So the dayanim, they're supposed to have, zakenim. In the pasuk, it says, v'nagsha yivimto elav l'nei hazakenim. And it says, v'also yivimto hashara l'zakenim. So she has to go hashara el hazakenim. So who are the zakenim? So zakenim implies you need at least two dayanim. Ein bezdin shakos, you need a third dayan. So you need three dayanim. There's one opinion in the Tanaim that you need five dayanim. So since there is a notion that it has to be ashara, it has to be a public proceeding, so we try to have a lot of people around. So therefore, since there is an opinion among the Tanaim who says that you have five, so we add two nosafim, and this also creates a more of a probability that we're going to have at least 10 people present for the chalitza. There should be at least 10 people present. So you have three dayanim, then you have two nosafim. These are the two additional dayanim. The two additional dayanim, the psulim are less miyake because they're not official dayanim. You have the two additional dayanim, so they are called the nosafim. So you have a total of five. Then we also add on, for good measure, a couple of edim, two witnesses, even though the pasuk doesn't necessarily specifically call for witnesses. Presumably, anybody who would be there, even if they're appointed as witnesses or not, could be a witness for the proceeding. So we have two witnesses as well. We're supposed to have a total of 10 people. So in every single chalitza that I've ever done, usually there are between 15 and 20 men there. I think the one where I went to Philadelphia, there may have been around 50 because they brought a lot of people to see the chalitza. But generally speaking, you need to have at least 10 people so that it be a public event. And because of the fact that it says in the pasuk, that also yivimto hashara, that she has to go up to the shahr, a specific gate, a specific place where she's set aside. So therefore, the dayanim have to do a kfiyas makam for the chalitza. So a day before the chalitza, they sit down, at least the three dayanim have to sit down and say, this is the place where we're going to do the chalitza for tomorrow. And they say, we're setting aside this room, and they set up the room with the benches and the chairs exactly how it should be, and say, we're setting up this room tomorrow that this should be the chalitza for so-and-so, that so-and-so is going to do a chalitza for his sister-in-law so-and-so, who was married to her late husband so-and-so. And you say all of those things, and you set aside the room the day before. If the chalitza is going to be on Sunday, so you do the chabiyas makom on Friday, but you make sure that you establish a shahr. And it should always be an important place, like the base Knesset, the base Medrash. So here, when we do a chalitza here in the yeshiva, so since the Gluck Center was built, we've done two chalitzas in the official Beis Din room on the fifth floor. Before there was a Gluck Center, when Rav Melech Shechter Zechut Tzadik Lebracha used to be the dayan in charge of chalitza, so when he would do a chalitza, he would do a chalitza in first hall on the fifth floor. We would go into the big room. I remember going and watching him do a chalitza. That's how I got my first introduction to chalitza. I watched Rav Melech Shechter in front of a large room with lots and lots of tavidim, and we saw him do a chalitza. So they set aside this place, and since it says ve'alsa yivimto, so it should be a high place. So you've been on the highest floor. So we also, the fifth floor, since the fifth floor there was good enough, we also do it on the fifth floor. It's not the highest floor, it's a high floor, so we still do it on the fifth floor. Then you have to make sure she's a gedola. If she's a katana, so then it's no good. She has to be a gedola, he has to be a gadol. So if we know how old they are, is evidence about how old they are. So shanim, you can rely on this type of you can have evidence of how old they are, but you also need simanim. So if he has a beard, so that's considered to be a good siman. If she has children from another marriage, she still has to do a chalitza. She has children from another marriage, but that would be a banim harim and kisimanim. That would be a siman. If she doesn't have banim, it's complicated to establish a siman for a woman. If she's 35 years old, so then, by all accounts, she's reached more than half of Shivim Shana, of a standard lifespan, so then that's generally assumed to be okay. If she's below 35, she's not yet 35 years old in a day, so then it's a little bit, it can be a little bit more complicated. They talk about Dodim Gedolim being a sign. Now, since one of the parts of the Chalitza procedure, as outlined by the Torah, consists of three parts. The one part is the kriya sapsukim, that she has to make a statement saying me'inya b'mila kim la'achim shema yisrael lo'ava yami. My brother-in-law refuses to establish a name for his brother among the Jewish people. Lo'ava yami, he does not want to perform yibum. And then we speak to the husband, and he says lo chafasi l'kachta. I don't want to take her. And all of this has to be said by Lashon HaKodesh. This is very clearly spelled out. The Gemara in Sota talks about this is one of the cases that absolutely has to be said by Lashon HaKodesh. So you have to say it by Lashon HaKodesh. That's the Kriya. There's one more pasuk after the whole thing, after the other parts are over, but that's part of the Kriya. And then there's the actual Chalitza, which is that he puts on the Chalitza shoe. Since it says, V'chaltzon na'alo mi'araglo, you have to take a na'al from his foot, and that's the ikar part of the entire chalitza procedure. Nothing. That's the only part that's me'akev. You have to be roi for the other parts. But if you didn't do the other parts, it's still a kosher chalitza. If you didn't do the chalitza itself, the taking off of the shoe, so then it's not a kosher chalitza. This is the one part that's me'akev, is the taking off of the shoe. So that's the taking off. That's the chalitza sanal. And then there's the rikika. Then there's the yarkab ifanav. She has to spit in front of him. So she has to spit in front of him, so it has to be real, genuine spit that she spits out. It has to be that she's spitting out her phlegm, and she's not spitting out anything else. So therefore, she's not allowed to eat or drink, or even rinse her mouth the day of the chalitza, so that there not be anything extraneous that comes out of her mouth other than the actual rok. It has to be just pure and adulterated rok. And then there's one more pasuk afterwards when she says, "Kacha yaseh la'ish." This is what we do to the man, Asher lo yivnes beis achiv, who has not built his brother's house. So that's the entire, so the process, the entire sequence of the chalitza consists of those three parts. The kriya, followed by the chalitza, followed by the rakika, and then there's one pasuk at the end as well. So that's the chalitza process. You have to make sure, before the chalitza process, that you tell the woman that she's not allowed to have eaten or drunk anything that day. So that has to be confirmed. And then for the man, so it says, she has to take the shoe off of his foot. So that requires that it go directly me'araglo, not me'aliyah. It can't be from something which is on top of his foot. He can't be wearing socks, and he can't have any dirt. He shouldn't have any dirt underneath the shoe. So we make sure that he doesn't have any chatzitzas himself. So we make so we tell him, before the chalitza procedure, you need to clip your toenails, and you need to wash your foot. Now we know that... Stam regel, bo en raglo hayimanis, as we know from Mitzora, stam regel is a regel yamin, so it has to be his right foot. So that's an extremely important part of the procedure, that it be on his right foot. Some say that if he has a defective right foot, he can't even use the left foot. That's a question. It could be right foot is not dependent on which is his stronger foot, but that's an objective thing, that everybody has to use the right foot. So we always make sure that we ask whether she's a righty, because she's going to have to take the shoe off with her right hand. But it doesn't say anywhere in the parasha of chalitza that she has to remove it with her right hand. It just says, "B'chaltzon alo mi'araglo." She has to take it off. Let's say she doesn't have any hands. She could take it off with her teeth. That's not the end of the world. There's a little bit of discussion. Let's say she takes it off with her hand. It's not the stronger hand. Chaltza b'smol. So everyone knows chaltza b'smol psula, but that's just one shita. We don't pass like that shita. We pass even chaltza b'smol would also be a kashya chalitza. But we ask her anyway that are you a righty? Because we try to do it, you know, with the hand that should be the correct hand. We had a little bit of a maisa. One of the chalitzas that we had this year that it was a little bit difficult to determine whether she was a righty or a lefty. We had to ask a lot of questions to be mevarer because she did some things with her right hand, some things with her left hand. But the more important issue, more than her right hand, is his right foot. That this is if she doesn't take it from his right foot, you put it on the wrong foot, you put it on the left foot, so then you have a chalitza psula. It has to be on his right foot, the chalitza. That's an important and extremely integral part of the chalitza, making sure that you put it on the making sure that it's his right foot, and that we don't have a confusion. If she would be a left footy, so then the halakha is that we take it, we have a shoe for his right foot, and we have a shoe for his left foot, and she takes it off of both shoes. And we've never had a case where a person was not a right footy. How do you make sure that a person's a right footy? You ask him to walk. So you see which foot he puts forth first. So usually most people will put forth their right foot first. And we ask him, I learned this from a Melech Shechter. A Melech Shechter always asked him to kick the table, kick the chair. So we ask him to kick the chair, and invariably he will kick the chair with his right foot, even without any prodding. That's what people will do. Most people, they'll, you know, if I asked you to kick a chair, you would do it with your right foot. That's just automatic. So therefore, we clarify anyway. We ask him beforehand just to make sure that he's a right footy. And then 16. They should have in mind the kavana is actually miakev over here. Some say, look. What does it mean the kavanah is mi'akev? The kavanah that they should be doing this for purposes of a chalitza. So some say, yeah, of course they're doing it for purposes of a chalitza. You invited them to a chalitza, you have all these men with beards, you have, you know, a whole a script and a whole process, so it's obvious that they have kavanah. So that could be, it could be. But the explicit kavanah that they're supposed to have, and if only one of them has kavanah and not both of them, the Gemara says it's a chalitza psula. Chalitza psula is a real pain. So you have a chalitza psula, it's worse than not having a chalitza at all. Because let's say there were five brothers. So once you have a chalitza psula, say every other brother has to do a chalitza now. You have to redo the chalitza with everybody. Once it's a chalitza psula, you have to be chos to akol ha'achim. So you don't want a chalitza psula. So if only one of them has kavana and the other one doesn't have kavana, so that's a chalitza psula. So what's the kavana? The kavana is that the chalitza will remove the zika and permit her l'shuk. That she won't be tied up to the brother or brothers anymore. Now she'll be permitted to marry anybody else. Technically, she can't marry a kohen. That's a dindur rabbanon. You assume a dindur rabbanon. She can't marry a kohen. But in terms of the kavana, so she's being freed. She can marry anybody she wants, and the zika is being removed. And we make sure we get rid of any chatzitzos. Now we also say he does a kinyan agban the chalitza shu, because it says na'alo, right? So na'alo means what? Na'al shalo, right? But actually, not so much. So na'al shalo is not really the drush of na'alo. Na'alo means that it has to be lemidas raglo. that the shoe has to fit his nahal. That the nahal has to be his nahal in the sense that it fits his regal. It has to fit his foot. So most of the shoes are size 11, size 12, size 13, something in that range, where they won't be like too big that somebody would slip out of it. If they would slip out of it, it could be that the shoe won't be kosher, but it won't be so small that somebody with a big foot wouldn't be able to fit in it. So this is not the standard shoe that's used by the Beis Din of America. The Beis Din of America gave me their spare. And the regular shoe that the Beis Din of America has always used is a little bit bigger than this one. This one is around the size 11. So if somebody's a size 12, it could be a little bit of a problem. But the Beis Din shoe could fit even at size 12. And I believe it has, in fact. So you try to have a shoe that's nice and big that everybody can fit, but not too big that it wouldn't... he would be able to wiggle out of. So when you put the shoe on the foot, you have the fellow walk around a little bit just to make sure that it properly fits the foot. The Yam Shel Shalma seemed to be of the opinion that if the only way that it would fit the foot is through the tzuos, through the straps going around, but otherwise it wouldn't fit the foot, that's not good enough. It has to be that it would fit the foot even without the straps, but the straps just make it tighter and make it better. But it has to actually be not a low, it has to be lemidas raglo. So why then do we give him the shoe as a kinyan? Because there's a notion of this inyan as well, that maybe it should belong to him. But that's not the ikka drasha. The ikka drasha is that it should fit him. So if you're technically speaking, he didn't do a kinyan and he didn't end up owning the chalitza shoe, it'd still be kosher. But nonetheless, we make sure that he acquires the shoe. And as I mentioned before, have him kick a table to determine he is right-footed. Ensure that the shoe is placed on his right foot. And then, what about these loops and these... why is it such an interesting phenomenon? So, there's a question in the Gemara whether the nahal, this ideal Platonic idea of nahal, right? You know, Plato has these ideas, like, right, you go in the cave and you see things the way they really are. So this is Plato's shoe. This is like the way a shoe is really supposed to be. So why is a nahal exactly like this? So what are the aspects of a nahal? So there's a question whether a nahal is a minhal or a sandal. The Gemara has a whole discussion whether it's a minhal or a sandal. We don't really know what a sandal looks like. So this is essentially a minhal. But there were things that we know about a sandal that we try to put into this minhal. Like we know that a sandal is relatively hard leather, so therefore we try to make it somewhat hard leather. We know that tefiros are on the outside, so the sewings, the tefiros on the outside. We know that it has an eikid, it has a heel, so therefore we make sure that there's a heel that goes up nicely on the back of the shoe. We make it out of leather because there's a pasuk in Yechezkel, Tezayin, that says Ven Alech Tachash, that we're going to be adorned with the leather of or Kadosh Baruch Hu adorned us with the leather of a Tachash. A Tachash we know is a type of animal, right? Shesasu Gavnin Harbe, type of animal. So the Ven Alech Tachash implies since it's a Tachash that's made out of leather, the skin is leather, so it must be the Venal that now is leather. So therefore, the whole thing has to be leather. And then there are other practices that are brought down, that the shoe will be black and the straps will be white or off-white. All of those practices are here. Now, what about the notion of having straps and having these clasps? The clasps and the loops. So the clasps and the loops. So if you look at the Gemara, on Daf Kuf Beis Amud Aleph, so it talks about shitznin and misna. So shitznin are shinsin, right? Shinsin are these things. These are shinsin. These are loops and clasps. And misna is the strap. So therefore, we're told that those are elements of what the chalitza shoe is supposed to consist of. So therefore, that's what we have. So it's put on, put on the foot. I'll put it on my foot. I'll show you. I don't have any brothers. Okay. You see, you make sure it fits. Walk a little bit with it. Okay, it's nice. Feeling good. And then, it's assumed that when these things are normally put on, the normal way of wearing it would be that you clasp the clasps from bottom to top. So therefore, you first start by doing the bottom one. Then you do the middle one. Then you do the top one. Now, it says, me'al raglo would indicate that it goes, up here above the foot, but it can't go me'al. So me'al would be above the knee. So told me, akuba lamata is kashir, me'akuba lamala is pasul. So therefore, we make sure that everything is done underneath the knee. That's not such a big deal, but it has to be done underneath the knee. It's a little bit of discussion that maybe if you didn't really need the straps to tighten it all together and you put the straps above the knee, so the Rosh seems to hold that wouldn't necessarily be possible, but we don't even take any chances with that, and we make sure everything is below the knee. That's very, very important. And then, since the shoe is really supposed to cover the foot, we have in the back, we have these pegimos, where there are, if you look at the back, it's kind of these openings. The straps should really cover the openings to make sure that, you know, the straps therefore go directly in the araglot, go directly on the foot. But but this way you make sure you don't have a shoe that could be considered mifurat. That you know, it says minal below the minal mifurat, right? That you shouldn't have a minal which is in any way ripped or chaser. So therefore we make sure to put the straps in these little holes, little pegimos, in between. The different parts of the foot, and that you go around twice like this, and then you make these ties above the shoe. Okay, you tie it once, make it nice and tight, a nice, you know, tight tie. We always do these chalitzas together. One of the big mumkin is Rabbi Elia Lichter. So Rabbi Elia Lichter, you know, whenever we tie the shoe, he says fast. So for a while I thought, man, hurry up, I gotta get home. But anyway, man, it's tight. And you do a second time, and the second time is not quite as tight. The second time you make sure, because otherwise you don't want to make it too difficult for her to undo. And then you do a little bow on top of the two. You make a little bow. Alright. There you go. Okay? There's your chalitza shoe tied up. And then he stands with a chalitza shoe, walks with it again, and you have the yavam basically lean against the wall or a board, and there's a halacha that he has to kind of stamp his foot into the ground. Now what's this idea, that he has to push his foot into the ground, basically, so that there will be a real chalitza, that she will really be taking something off. So part of a taking off process is that when a person wears a shoe, generally speaking, so they wear a shoe in a way in which they're wearing it and walking with it, and they're on the ground. So you're going to take off somebody's shoe. Part of the taking off process is the lifting up of a shoe, right? If I'm going to take off my shoe, there's a process. Part of the process is that I lift it up, and then I take it off. So therefore, the taking off of the shoe process consists really of all of these different parts, where basically she undoes the clasp. So the first, the bottom one, then the middle one, then the top one. She undoes the strap, the bow, and the two knots. After she undoes the strap, then she undoes the clasps, bottom, middle, top. Then she, with her left hand, because one hand is going to have to lift up his foot, so she'll lift up the back of his foot with her left hand, and then with her right hand, she will actually take off the shoe. Taking off of the shoe should be done completely by her right hand, which is her stronger hand. And it's very important, since this is the main part of the chalitza procedure, the chalitza, she has to do the chalitza, that he can't help at all. So one of the things that we continuously emphasize throughout the entire procedure is, you remain completely passive, because he might be a nice guy. You might feel bad for her. Here she is, you know, kind of bending down. We tell her she shouldn't even put on his... He's be'amud, right? That he's supposed to be standing up. We tell her as well that she shouldn't be sitting when she does this. She should, you know, stand the whole time. She could, you know, can bend over, but she's not supposed to be standing either. So it's a very difficult thing for her. Sometimes it's an older lady, and she has to bend down and do the whole thing. So he might be compassionate and try to help her out. So we say, no, you'll be hurting her by helping her. You got to be completely passive. So he has to be passive, and she has to lift up her foot, the foot. So the lifting up the foot, she could do with her left hand, from the back of his foot. But then the whole taking off, she has to do with her right hand. So she first undoes the straps, and then she undoes the clasps, and then she, when she lifts up her foot, his foot, so then with her right hand, she, when she lifts up his foot, with her right hand, she takes the foot, the shoe from his foot, and she has to throw the shoe. She throws the shoe some distance, and that's a full indication of her removing the shoe, v'chalsa nalo mi'araglo, that she is absolutely removing the shoe from his foot.
And that is essentially the main part of the chalitza procedure, is that this appropriate taking off of the shoe, this appropriately manufactured chalitza shoe, which is put on. Everybody has the requisite kavanah, and she does this in front of the dayanim so everybody can see the chalitza properly taking place. Okay? Anybody want to try a hand at it? Taking off of the chalitza shoe?
Sure.
Yes, sir.
Desk is blocking the viewer.
All right. That's right. You know, not he. He has to lean in such a way that if he would pull out the wall, he wouldn't fall. It should be, you know, standing so that, you know, so it's a leaning. Just to be able to get the foot into the ground, but so that, remember, just the right hand. So don't help out with the left hand. Okay?
You're being bad.
Look, there are bidyevitz if he helps out a little bit and so forth, but you don't want to get into these types of shilas.
It's also male.
Now with the left hand, you lift up the back of the foot, okay? So that you'll be... No, the foot, not the shoe. The back of the foot.
Like
the shoe.
This?
What?
Incoming inside?
No, you lift it up like this.
Like
this, you lift up the foot. Okay. But then you throw it. Throw. Okay, very good. Okay. Okay, after the chalitza takes place, so it says in the pasuk. Yes, thank you. Okay, so it says in the pasuk, okay, v'yarkah b'fanof, that she has to spit in front of him. So this requires that it's not just a spitting, but it has to be a spitting in his presence. Now, it doesn't have to hit him. In fact, it's not supposed to hit him. If you look at Rashi, the Torah, Rashi actually says al hakarka. So she spits on the karka, she says spits on the ground, but as she spits on the ground in his presence. He has to see the rok, ideally. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. He's supposed to see the rok. So that if, you know, the rok, for example, let's say she's very, very tall, and the rok goes down from her mouth, and then a wind blows it away, and it evaporates before it gets to, let's say she's, you know, 7 feet, and he's, you know, 4'10", and before it gets, when it's in the between 5 and 6 feet, the whole thing evaporates. That's no good, because it wasn't fun up. So it has to be, you know, in front of him that he's able to see it. And the dayanim are supposed to be able to see the spit. So therefore, we ask her to expectorate with all of her strength and all of her might, and to get a really good gezunt piece of rok, you know, going there, and have the spittle be visible when it comes out of her mouth. That's the other thing that I mentioned in the checklist, which is to make sure that she faces him when she expectorates. What I mentioned here as well is that to try as best as possible to see no words repeated in the recitation of the psukim. Because the formulation is very specific, it's important that everything be enunciated properly. In fact, there are even certain words that are supposed to be said right next to each other, like, for example, lo ava yabami. So there's a kapeda that lo ava should be said together, because otherwise it sounds like lo ava yami. You know, that really, my yabam really does want. So therefore, and the same thing with lo chafasi lakakta. It shouldn't be lo chafasi lakakta. No, I, you know, like, no, yes, yes. People speak that way all the time. No, yes, you know. I think I saw something like that in the Purim spiel. So therefore, it's important that these words, that the lo ava, lo chafatzti, be right next to each other in the way that they're recited. Again, from context, it might be clear anyway, but as best as possible, you try to have these things formulated in that fashion. And the others are office notes. I didn't give you a copy of the chalitza certificate. There used to be a much more lengthy form of shtar chalitza that would be provided afterwards, but now it's just sort of a simple short form chalitza certificate, very similar to a get certificate, that just basically recites that the chalitza was properly performed and she's free to remarry anybody other than a kohen. And that's, you know, basically how it is formulated. Now, what happens if she didn't know about this whole thing about chalitza? This chalitza thing was kind of very remote to her. It wasn't something that was on her radar. And she married somebody else by mistake. So the Rama paskins, and this is a sugya in the Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Beis, really, that in such a case, she's really not supposed to stay with the guy she married. Even if it was Bishoge, she's supposed to, the Rama paskins this way, that she's supposed to do the chalitza, then get from the person that she was married to, and go on with the question as to Kedusha Tovsin, but then she's supposed to marry somebody else afterwards and not to stay with this fellow. So this has led to all kinds of shilos because there were lots of mistakes. But Moshe Feinstein deals with a case in his Chelek Aleph. There's a similar of Evan Ezer, a similar case in Chelek Dalav of Evan Ezer, where Moshe Feinstein deals with the following situation: a Masada Kiddushin asked a woman who was an almana. And now she's getting remarried, and he was the Masada Kiddushin, so he asked the right question. He said, did you have any children? So he didn't ask it as precisely as he should have. So he asked her, did you have any children? So she said, yeah, sure. So good, fine. So I don't have to worry about Yibam Machalisa. So he performed the marriage, they got married, everything is fine and good. Then it transpired that although she answered the question precisely, he didn't ask it precisely. He should have asked, did you have any children through this husband? But she had children. She had children from a previous husband. But that doesn't help for Yibum HaChalitza purposes. Since she didn't have children through this husband, therefore she was, in fact, required to undergo Chalitza. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that this halacha, first of all, they bring a Knesset Yecheskel that if it's less than Shogeg, if it's an Onis Gomor, for somebody got married in a situation where it was mamish, they did everything in their power to ascertain that they didn't require Yimam Chalitza, but they just didn't realize there was somebody out there, so maybe there's room to be made. Because Moshe Feinstein writes that the whole gzeira over here, the whole din over here is a gzeira, that we shouldn't, if we're going to be mekel here, maybe we'll be mekel in the case of the woman who remarries, whose husband is missing at sea, and who went to the Medina Sayyam, and she didn't proper, and she got married too soon. We're there, that's where there's much more of a concern, because even if she was involved in Znus, we would say Kshem Shasu Labal Ken Asu Labal. Here, the halacha is that if a woman's mezana, she doesn't become a sur. It's only because it's only in a case where she's married, where it's more equivalent to Isha Shahalacha Halacha Baila Dina Sayyam. The whole thing is Xera. Since he said the whole thing is Xera, here, it doesn't make sense to impose Xera. This is a case where the Yavam himself was a very Fum Yid. Everybody here was very Fum. The Yavam, the brother in law, would have been more than happy to have done the Chalitza. It's just that the Masada Kiddusha didn't ask the right question. So, because of the fact that it was a Psak Batos, based on an unclear understanding of the answer that she gave, but there was nothing malicious that was going on over here, so therefore he thinks that you could be makel in this type of a case to allow her to remain married to the Yavam. So in the Sefer Chalitza Kehilchos has a similar question regarding the following situation, where the woman registered to get married with the registry of marriage with the Rabbanut in Israel, and they asked her, did you have any children with your previous husband who died? And she said, sure. And they allowed her to get married, and then it turned out, yeah, they had a child, an adopted child. So it wasn't a biological child, it was an adopted child. But nobody asked her to clarify whether it was adopted or biological, but an adopted child doesn't help for Yibum HaChalitza purposes. In the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, unfortunately, we had a number of cases of young men who had perished in the World Trade Center, and whose cases had to be examined to determine apidin, that they had died, and that the wives would be allowed to remarry, but the wives were widows. So in four of the cases that I dealt with, the couple only had one child, and the child was born either 1 or 2 weeks before September 11th, or in two of the cases, the child was born after September 11th. And when it was actually one of these Milberes cases, we had to wait and see whether she gave birth to a Vlad Shel Kayama, and in both cases, Baruch Hashem, she gave birth to a Vlad Shel Kayama. So she didn't have to do Chalitza. But in two of the cases, one case of the woman, and they didn't have any children whatsoever. She wasn't pregnant. They didn't have any children. They were newlyweds. They just gotten married. And we had to do Chalitza with the brother-in-law. And in another case, they had been married for a number of years, but they had no biological children. They had an adopted child. So since there was an adopted child, it was a little bit traumatic, you know, from a pastoral perspective to explain that even though there was a child that they very much viewed as their own child in every way, nonetheless, from a halakhic perspective, the child wasn't able to exempt the woman from having to do chalitza. So in that case as well, we did a chalitza because it was not a biological child. But we ascertained that it was not a biological child. So here, they had not ascertained that it was not a biological child. So the question was posed to a number of rabbanim of Yecheskel, Stern is it? Was the mechaber of the sefer Chalitza Kehilchasa? No, I'm getting the name wrong. Rabbi Yecheskel Schwartz is the mechaber of the sefer Chalitza Kehilchasa. So he posed this question to a number of rabbanim whose names he doesn't list because he disagrees with them, I guess. So he has these rabbanim chashuvim who all explained that in this case they thought this was an onus and they couldn't penalize the woman. They quoted Rav Moshe and they thought that it should be permissible for the woman to remarry. And he disagreed with them. He said, no, Rav Moshe's case was different. Rav Moshe's case, she got a psak from a Morah Horah. He gave a psak, and it's just that the facts weren't adequately explained, and therefore a mistake was made. Or a mistake was made in Horah. But in this case, it was the woman who was misleading the registry. She should have clarified that it was a biological child. The other case, the woman answered truthfully, do you have a child? She said, yeah, I have a child. In this case, you have a child. She sort of should have said, I have a child, but it's not a biological child. So he thought that it was more suspicious, and that under these circumstances, maybe there was room to prohibit her to the next husband. So I don't know. You can take a look at the different essays and decide for yourselves. But that's an interesting discussion. And it's halakha l'maise, because unfortunately this does come up. What also sometimes comes up is that the Masada Kiddushin is about to perform the wedding, and 2 days before he performs the wedding, suddenly it occurs to him that this woman is a widow, and she didn't have any children, and maybe there's a brother out there, and they need a chalitza. So what if you contact the brother-in-law sort of on an emergency basis and he performs the chalitza? So can you then go forward and perform the marriage immediately afterwards? Do we say that you have to wait any period of time between the chalitza and when the woman's allowed to marry? So we say the chalitza has to be performed at least 3 months, after 92 days, right, after the husband dies. But is there any waiting period beyond that? So the Piskei Teshuvah in Hilchos Nida quotes the Shaar Ephraim, who says, Dam Chimud. You got to wait 7 days. We have a halacha in Hilchos Nida that when a woman is, when a man proposes a wedding proposal to a woman, so then she gets all excited, and we assume that some dam comes down, even if she's not a bas dam, even if she's 95 years old. We assume that we have to worry about dam chimud, and she has to wait 7 days, just to count 7 days of clean days before she's able to get married. So the Shaar Ephraim says that the same is true with respect to a chalitza. We don't know when, even if there's somebody who's out there who's designated to marry her, So who knows if the brother-in-law is going to do the chalitza. So until the point that the chalitza is done, she doesn't really have the full-fledged expectation or comfort level that she's about to get married. So therefore, you can't start counting the 7 days until after the chalitza. So that's a question, because the case of the Shaar Ephraim is talking about a case where there really was a suffix, whether the chalitza, whether the brother, was going to go forward with the chalitza or not go forward with the chalitza. But maybe in a case where she has somebody she's planning to marry, and she's completely comfortable that the marriage is going to take place because the brother-in-law is the most cooperative, nicest guy in the world, and of course he's going to do the chalitza. So even though she has to wait 3 months, maybe the 7 days could be subsumed within the 3 months, and she doesn't have to wait another 7 days after the chalitza. So that's a whole question. It's a whole dion. He has the Shach Levitari about this in the Sefer Chalitza Kehilchasa as well. Where the person who writes to him is noted to be machmer, and he's noted to be a little bit more makel if there's a case where there are very compelling reasons to be makel, especially given that the Shaar Ephraim's case was a case where she really had reason to worry that maybe the chalitza wouldn't take place, and therefore maybe she didn't have the comfort level or excitement level of marriage until after the chalitza. So that's a question, but it's halacha l'maaseh. Rav Schefter, at the beginning of the year, told a story, I think, in the Voyers community, where a man was planning to get married to a Shemeres Yavam, and it turned out that she didn't do a chalitza, so therefore they made sure that the chalitza was done, and immediately afterwards they ran to get married later that day, and they wanted to then go away on a honeymoon, whatever, and the kehillah wouldn't let them. They said, no, you got to wait 7 days, because dam chimud. They wouldn't rely on any clues. So there's a halacha that's brought down the Shaar Ephraim. You got to wait 7 days for the shower because of the dam chimud. So that could be halacha lemaisa in terms of what goes on. What was very halacha lemaisa and happened a lot in Europe was a case where a woman married a man, and the man was a wonderful, suitable mate for her, but the man had a brother who was not quite on the same level as her husband. And the brother was somebody who was a mishumad, somebody who abandoned the religion altogether, and would certainly not be somebody who could be counted upon to ever perform a chalitza. So there would be a concern, especially in those days, it was more common, the couples might not have children before the husband died, and she would be stuck basically having a zika with this ach mishumad, with this ach mumer, who would never perform a chalitza. And what could she do if she wanted to get married and yet avoid this type of predicament? So there's a shita, there's a machlokas, it's brought in, I have in the materials, it's brought in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Nun Zayin, machlokas geonim, between Rabbi Yehudaigon and Rashi Ragon. Rabbi Yehudaigon was of the opinion that somebody who was a mishumad, he's not in the parsha of chalitza altogether, says, ki Yeshu Acham Yaktav, he's not an ach, he's this is not my brother, I don't know who this is, a stranger. This is not somebody who's really a part of the family anymore. So he felt that this person's not really a brother, and you don't even, and there's no Zika, and you don't have to worry about Yibam, and you don't have to worry about Chalitza in such a case. So Shri Ragon said, it can't be. Such a thing is absolutely impossible, and that a Jew is a Jew is a Jew, right? Yisrael af b'shachati, or af b'shachati Yisrael, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, that even though a person sins, if they were born a Jew, once a Jew, always a Jew. So therefore, you can't get out of this. And there was some who tainted that this Rav Yehudai Gon, he wasn't, he was apparently sight impaired. Apparently, he was vision impaired. He wasn't able to see. And that he didn't review all of his notes. And some of the Talmidim played a prank or whatever and wrote this in his notebooks and he didn't know about it. So he wasn't really from Yehudai Gon. That's what they say. The Bara Gola quotes this, that he didn't know. There was some Talmidim who wrote this down in his notebooks, but Rabbi Yehudai Gon never really said such a thing. So that's a question, whether that could be relied upon. So the Ramah says, the Mechaber Ramah, don't pask in this way. The Ramah says, you can't rely upon this. It's interesting, he quotes that maybe if it took for the marriage, if she got married to somebody else, that she wouldn't have to get divorced. That's also a chiddush. But the Ramah gives a different answer. Says, okay, let's say that we're not going to rely, l'chatzkila, certainly, on this idea that an Ach Meshumud is excluded from Achba, but he says you can make a Tanai. A Tanai ben Isuin. Ooh, a Tanai ben Isuin. This is something that we say, ain't tonight, but he's suing. You can't make a condition to say, I'm married to you, but if such and such happens, it'll turn out the whole marriage is off 10 years after the fact. Such a thing happens 10 years after the fact, the whole marriage is off. So normally we don't allow that. We don't allow that because we assume that once a person is already having relations with his wife, even if there was some sort of tanai in the original formulation of the marriage, all tanai have been waived. Nobody wants to turn his bios into, to turn his bia into bilas nus. So we assume that all tanai are waived. But here's the one exception. The one exception. So this is codified in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kuf Nun Zayin and Eben Ezer that a woman can get married and they make a tanai that if she should be, if they end up not having any children together and the husband dies and she's no fellas in front of her, in front of his brother who's the Ach Mumer, then it will turn out that they were never really married. It'll turn out retroactively they were never really married. So they make this tanai and everybody, and this is assumed to be one tanai that works because for her benefit, the husband never wants to waive it. Up until the very end, he never wants to waive this. He loves her so much that he would want this tonight to be in effect in the event that that he dies. So therefore, he doesn't waive it. She doesn't waive it. They both want the tonight to be in effect throughout. So as long as this tonight is made, tonight couple made properly and so forth. So then, in those cases where the husband would die, so then she would be off the hook because it'll turn out that she wasn't really married altogether, and therefore she wouldn't have to do chalitza with the akmumer. Then the Noda Yehuda and others extend this to other cases. They say not only can the tonight be made in the event that there's a brother who's a mumar, but even in the event that there's a brother who's a cheresh, there's a brother who is just a deaf mute, and he's not going to be able to have the requisite das to do chalitza, so even with a deaf mute, such a tanai can be made as well, that to somebody who's mentally incapacitated, mentally dysfunctional, and it's known that the brother is mentally dysfunctional, so then you'd be allowed to have such a tanai as well. And then they also extend it to the case of a brother who's missing. That they know that it's known that there's a brother, but nobody knows where the brother is. The brother hasn't been seen or heard from in about 10 years. So nobody knows where the brother is. So we have to wait. If we know that he had a brother, we don't know that he's dead. She's going to be stuck. She'll be an aguna. If the husband dies without any children. So therefore, even in a case where it's an achnelam, a brother who's completely missing, so they allowed such a tanai as well. There were all kinds of takanas that were put into place because this was a real concern. When we talk about the aguna problem in Europe, one of the biggest aguna problems were these chalitza cases, where a man died and he had a brother who was just completely outside of the community, who was not going to cooperate in any way, shape, or form with respect to chalitza. So this was one of the ways that they dealt with it. Another way that they dealt with it, interestingly, is that they would sometimes have a shtar in which a man would commit himself. You can't. A compelled chalitza is not a valid chalitza, but somehow they felt that getting assurances out of a fellow was something that was a little bit better. So at the time of the marriage, if it was known that a man had brothers, they would have either all the brothers, maybe the oldest brother, they would have the brother sign a shtar committing that in the event that his brother would die without any children, that he would agree that he would take care of a chalitza. There was one local rabbanim who once shared such a shtar with me, told me that he still uses it. This was about 10 years ago. He told me out of Yom Hazeh, if it was Masada Kiddushin, and the husband had a brother, he would have the shtar. Sorry, this good faith commitment that the fellow would not hold back the chalitza if ever necessary. I was sort of taken by surprise because I'm not familiar with any other rabbanim who used this form. I'm not even sure that this rabb still uses the form 10 years later. But I did see such a form at one point in time. I'm not sure if the Beis Din still has it in its archives, but it's an interesting form. Yes?
Do they take any precautions today? So if they don't use that shtar, what do they do today?
Well, technically speaking, today you could do such a tanai. If it's known that you have a brother-in-law who's a meshuma, then they could get married. I'll be such a tanai.
Brothers are going to be doing 20 years down the line. 10 years, you know what's going to happen.
They talk about it being the case that the fellow's a meshuma at the time of marriage, where it's clear that there is a smichas das, that this is something that she's really worried about, because otherwise, who says that she's really going in with this notion of condition? If she knows that there's a good chance that she's going to fall in front of an achah mumar for yibum purposes, because he's an achah mumar at the time of marriage, so then she's going to take this tanai very seriously. So that's the case that they talk about. That's the case they talk about. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting tshuva. It's hard to know what to make of the tshuva. It's a very interesting tshuva about a woman who got married. They didn't make a tanai at all. She got married to a man who was going off to the army a month after the marriage. It was known that half the people who went off to the army in this battle were going to, I'm not sure which battle it was, half the people who were going off were going to get killed. So it was clear that it was very, very likely that her husband was, she was marrying him under circumstances in which it was very likely that he was going to die in a few months. But somehow she was married him anyway. But it was very clear that he might die in a few months. And he had a brother who was a member of the local government, which was completely secular, where the brother was completely divorced from religion, and even if he wanted to do a favor to her by doing chalitza to her, he would get into serious trouble from the authorities. So it was very clear that it just wasn't shayach, but she didn't know that there was such a thing anymore as not being able to remarry without yibum or chalitza in the event that her husband would die. So she didn't do anything. So Moshe, this is on page 22, deals with this question. And he writes, I have some of the parts underlined. You look on the right side. It's obvious to everybody that for such a short time, the yamim, rafilu kadashim, for days or even months, so he kind of throws in sort of a kiddushin tos idea. He says that there's no way that she would have married if she was like aware of circumstances. Since it's known, it was under circumstances where she knew that he was likely to die in war. She didn't know about the whole Yom HaChalitza thing. Then the next line, had she known, she wouldn't even have married this guy. Even for a month or two. Mistaber, go on to the next online. It's probably true of the husband she married too. The guy who are vada, you there, she was sure Yamam Watam La Yamotse Shumisha Baolam Shitinase. he would also know that it would be impossible for him to marry any woman in law tonight, if not for the fact that they would make a tonight, Shim Yamas, that if he would die below Banim without any children, Lokichab, that it's not really a marriage. Umdana Brua, Shirakal tonight, Mishnah Zlodin, and therefore there's an Umdana that they got married through the tonight. Why would they make a tonight? It's an Umdana that they both would understand that they wouldn't get married under these circumstances unless it was a tonight. So therefore it's almost like an unansadi that we're going to treat it as if there was a tonight. Vihi Umdana Brua, Khan and Sadi. This is an Umdana Brua, Khan and Sadi, says Ramosha, Shabalo Kidushin, Kishimes Mokhama, that the Kiddushin obviously were intended to unravel, and that was everybody's understanding and the clear Umdana Hamuchach at the time that they got married, that the marriage would unravel if he would die Vinafel Fene Yavim without any children, and that she would be stuck in front of this Yavim Azesh. Rashi was a Rashi Mekopher, a Chavim Meflogan, a member of the government. Shoshia Klaus Shiaklos, so that there was a Shoshia Klaus Shiaklos. There'd be no chance that he would do Chalitza, Tishai Arguna. But when drama, Shafilo Gilam Milsa Lotzar. They don't even have Gilam Milsa in this case. So Moshe raises the possibility, even when they didn't do it tonight. So that they wouldn't have gotten married without a tonight. So he reads it tonight into the marriage. So that's an incredible. So he says, so she imu ba open on inside the bar next she kinu be obatlo. So then it's considered as if they made it tonight, and therefore the condition obatlo. So this is a phenomenal chiddush. But I don't know. You know, to what degree, you know, this can always be, this could be utilized. But Moshe kind of carries it out in a case where there was no Tanai, to read a Tanai under, admittedly, where were very, very extreme circumstances, the case that Moshe was dealing with. Yes?
Was this written for America?
No. This case was not written for America. It was some case I don't know. He wrote the.
He says it's a woman from Bukhara.
Yes, it's from Bukhara. So it sounds like it has to do with some Bukharian situation. But it's just an interesting tshuva in terms of the literature and in terms of these types of situations. Sometimes it's bad blood. Between the sister-in-law and brother-in-law. It's not always such a rosy, peachy relationship, and sometimes it does take a while to be able to cajole the Yavam to perform the Chalitza. That's why I always like to give a little bit of a speech at the end of a Chalitza procedure. So you come to the very end of the whole Chalitza procedure. I should mention that when we do the Kriya at the end, so she says three times, Beis Chalutzanah, Beis Chalutzanah, Beis Chalutzanah, and everybody there is supposed to say three times, Chalutzanah, Chalutzanah, Chalutzanah. So that's it. So there's audience participation too. So that's the one part that everybody participates in. It's brought down that the people who are present are supposed to say Chalutzanah three times. We kind of have, you know, a public affirmation of the event and of the finality of the Chalitza. Then you go to the very end of the procedure, 50. I'll give you the lines 50 to 53. We'll end there. 50. The brother-in-law presents shoe back to original owner. So that since I gave the gift, right, the Bezin gave the gift to the brother-in-law, so we have the brother-in-law give the shoe back to the Bezin. The Bezin makes a kinyan, and once again it has returned to the Bezin's possession. And then the rabbis say, Yiratzon shlotavona od benosi solo de chlitzav lo de yibum. That we don't consider it to be a happy thing. It's not a happy occasion, because a chalitza comes about when a man dies. He dies so often young, and he dies without children, so it's not considered to be a happy event. So we say we hope that this should not continue anymore. And then there's a bracha. Bracha sheki d'sham v'tzav v'chukav shel Avraham Avinu. Why are we making reference to Avraham Avinu? This is based on a medrash. The medrash says that when Avraham refused to take from the spoils of the war, when he rescued his nephew and brother-in-law Lot from those who had taken Lot hostage in the war of the four kings versus the five kings, so when he finally was able to rescue the five kings, so he refused to take Mechutriad Tzvochnal. He wouldn't take a srochnal, he wouldn't take a shoe strap. So the Medrash says, in reward for the fact that he wouldn't take the shoe strap, he was awarded with a mitzvah of chalitza. So the question is, what kind of a great reward is this? There's a Gemara version that says he was rewarded with tefillin. So that we understand, tefillin is such a nice thing. Chalitza, we just said we hope chalitza never happens. So what kind of a great reward is this? So I like to say that maybe this is a kind of trying to reinforce the notion of a chesed, which was exemplified by Avraham Avinu, that Avraham didn't necessarily at that point in time have the closest relationship with Lot, but Lot was a relative of his. So the fact that Lot was some sort of a relative caused Avram to act so incredibly unselfishly, and he wouldn't take from any of the spoils, and he put his life at risk, and he went against these four powerful kings in order to be able to rescue Lot, and it was all done completely unselfishly. So therefore, that mitzvah is rewarded through the giving of the mitzvah of chalitza, which also requires a brother-in-law who may not necessarily have the closest relationship with the sister-in-law, who might be reeling with sorrow from the fact that his brother died and feeling terrible about the whole situation. Now he has to come. He has to go through this whole chalitza ceremony. He's just going to take off a shoe. He has to take off his shoe in front of everybody, and he has to have her spit in front of him and the whole business. And nonetheless, he goes through with this entire procedure. He goes through with this entire matter, so that is an exemplification of the chesed ideals that were represented by Avram Avinu. And that's why, as a result of Avram's act of chesed, what follows is the mitzvah of chalitza, which requires the exhibition of the same types of qualities, and that's why we make the bracha, bracha sheh kedisham tzav v'chukav shel Avram Avinu. So yehi ratzon that this should only be a theoretical discussion, and in fact, menasi so shouldn't have to come any more lidei chalitza v'lo lidei yibum. Thank you.